So as I mentioned, I got back from retreat Tuesday evening and didn't have a lot of time to prepare this Dharma talk, so half of it is going to be reflections on the retreat. And before I begin, I want to know, do any of you know who Venerable Anālio is? One, two, three. Okay. Well, that's good. And I get to tell you a little bit about him. Bhikkhu Anālio is a German man. He is a monk. He ordained in Sri Lanka, I think they said in, I don't remember, honestly. He's 52 years old now, though. And he is what's called a scholar monk, as well as a practicing monk. And he is an amazing presence, and he's really shaking up the Theravada world with his research. I went on a retreat that he held at Insight Retreat Center, Gill's Place, 2 years ago. It was quite something, and I felt very fortunate to get into this retreat at Spirit Rock. There was apparently hundreds of people who were on the waiting list trying to get in. So what he does is he is trying to determine what the real original teachings of the Buddha, where all the traditions stem from, what they are. Because even in the Pali Canon, which we are very proud in our Theravadan tradition saying these are the core teachings and we have it, they're not. They've been added on to, they've been edited, they've been compromised, as Tony Bernhardt has said a couple times, especially about women in the Sangha. Cranky monks obviously wrote this stuff or added to it, because that's just not possible, some of these things that have been said. So Anālio researches this, and the way he researches it is he goes to the Pali Canon first, and then he goes what are called the Chinese Agamas. And the Chinese Agamas are the Chinese version of the Pali Canon, and they go back to only a couple of hundred years after the Buddha died. These were pilgrims who came to India, copied down the Pali Canon, took it back to China. And so when the Muslim invasion took place and everything was destroyed except what made it to Sri Lanka, that's what we are using as our basis for the core teachings. What Anālio is doing is comparing those to the Chinese Agamas. So he is fluent in Pali, he's fluent in ancient Chinese and ancient Tibetan, because he also found Tibetan texts that go back quite a bit, and he compares those as well. So what he does is, in particular, the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the basis for Vipassana and mindfulness and everything that we're doing, not just in Buddhist sanghas, but you know, the whole mindfulness movement is based on the Satipatthana Sutta and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. What he did was go through the Satipatthana and compare it with the Chinese Agamas, the two Agamas, and he started throwing out anything that was not in all three. He said that means it was added on, a later commentary. So now the Satipatthana Sutta has changed a bit according to him. And as he emphasized with us, he said it does not mean what is in there is not valuable. It's found elsewhere, but it was most likely not in the original Satipatthana Sutta. So, for example, the first contemplation in the Satipatthana is contemplating the body, right? The body as a body. And there are six body contemplations that you practice. And he said, no, there's actually only three. There's three that are in these three versions, the oldest versions that can be found of the original teachings. And they are the anatomical parts, the elements, and corpse contemplation. And interestingly enough, and those of you who have taken my Maranasati A Year to Live course, I talked to him briefly about this, He said, as far as he's concerned, that's the most important contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta. It is the most relevant, and it's the one that is directly talking about impermanence, which most of us don't want to face. The next two are feelings and mind states, and they are found both in the Pali Canon and the Chinese Agamas. But then when we get to dhammas or mind phenomena, he could only find two. And that was the hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. So what he did, he first of us showed us how he came with this, compared all the suttas and showed the comparisons. Then he has developed a meditation based on the entire Satipatthana Sutta that you can do in a sitting based on this new research. And it was quite an experience working with this. Interestingly, as I mentioned, the corpse contemplation, contemplating the impermanence of the body, he gave that teaching one evening. I walked down the street at Spirit Rock where there are three horses, and they were just euthanizing one of the horses who had developed septus, and watched as he died. And I just thought, I can't believe this is happening. This is so synchronistic and so strange. And sat there just watching this body of a horse, and went back the next morning, and just as you know, the teachings say, the body becomes bloated, it becomes festered, you know, it goes through the various things that happen as a corpse deteriorates. And people were just walking down and placing flowers and branches and things on this horse's body as it started to deteriorate. So it was a really profound experience, and just very ironic this happened to take place the night that he was teaching, contemplating impermanence through body awareness. So, this is he is also a student of Bhikkhu Bodhi's. And Bhikkhu Bodhi has said, you know, it's very satisfactory when you find a student who surpasses the teacher. And he apparently has, with the amount of scholarship, and not just scholarship. I've never had a teacher or sat with anybody who has such presence and also can sit for hours on end. He seems to never eat. He just sits with this beautiful smile on his face for literally 3 or 4 hours at a time. And what was strange was the rest of us found ourselves sitting for the same amount of time, almost effortlessly. And he said, I'm not going to ring a bell. I'm not going to do anything like that. You come and go as you want. You're grown-ups. But I'm going to sit here. This for me is my practice. And so people, as they grew tired, would leave and do walking meditation. He doesn't do any walking meditation. He just sits. And then we'd come back in and he'd still be sitting there. He'd get up for his one meal a day, then go back and sit till nighttime. And then give a talk in the evening. And anyway, it was a very, very deep and powerful experience. This is a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi on the Satipatthana. It might be maintained that Satipatthana is called Ikkhayamajja, the direct path, to distinguish it from the approach to meditative attainment that proceeds through the jhanas or the brahmaviharas. While the latter can lead to nibbana, they do not do so necessarily, but can lead to sidetracks, whereas Satipatthana leads invariably to the final goal. That's quite a statement, and also Shaila Catherine was one of the co-teachers at this, and she talked a little bit about the jhanas and said, unfortunately, so many people are so wrapped up with the jhanas and the conceit that goes along with it, that please pay attention to this quote and pay attention to this direct path. Also, if any of you have read the Satipatthana Sutta, there's a refrain in it, and I know when I was studying it, I kind of skipped over it because it said the same thing over and over and over again, you know, like so many things do. The refrain is, for each contemplation, in this way he remains focused internally on the body, in this case in the body, and in of itself, or externally on the body, in and of itself, or both internally and externally on the body, in and of itself. And he remains independent, unsustained, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a monk remains focused on the body, in and of itself, and then it goes through feelings and mind states and dhammas. Yeah, I never paid attention to this part because it's repeated over and over and over again and you skip over it. And Analio said he did too until he realized how important it was. He said it's something that we tend to forget when studying the Satipatthana Sutta. It says internally and externally. And I know when Rich and I were taking our mentoring course with Dennis, we discussed this. So what does external mean? You know, does it mean external body, internal mind? Does it mean observing someone else externally, like watching them? You know, it's never really explained. And Analio came up with a simile, and he said, think of it in terms of a lotus. The lotus closes up. And that's internal examination. And he said, and then it opens up. And that's external examination, examining your practice in the world. And when you do that, when you open up, you're allowing the seeds to blossom and to leave, which form the Brahma Viharas. He said, this is a wisdom practice, and with this you develop a compassion practice. So, because he's a scholar monk, guess what his next adventure is? He's looking into the Brahma Viharas and the original teachings, and he's writing a book on it, which is supposed to be published, I believe, next year. By the way, this is his latest book. We had to read it before we went to the retreat. It's his second book on the Satipatthana, and he just refined some of his research. So, practicing externally, not something we talk a lot about in this practice, except in terms of the Brahma Viharas. And he emphasized it's extremely important to be practicing externally, in the world. And so I thought, okay, well, this is a good time to talk about the Kosambiya Sutta, which is Majjhima Nikaya 48. Rich and Laura and I, and maybe somebody else in here, Barbara maybe, were taking the Majjhima Nikaya course that Gil offers online. And Rich and I decided for the next couple of months what we would talk about is, you know, one of the suttas that we especially were affected by. And to be honest, I wasn't especially affected by the Kosambi Sutta. However, I know it, so I didn't have to spend a lot of time researching it. And I could kind of come in here and do my shtick with it. But it is about practicing externally. And that, for me, was one of the really defining points of this retreat, about how important it is to practice externally with the Satipatthana. I have mentioned this before to you. There is a very good book called The Kosambi Intrigue by Susan Stone. Read it?
Yes,
I definitely recommend it. It's called The Kosambi Intrigue by Susan Stone, and it is based on this sutta. And there's also a very good portion of it where she goes into what she had to make up, because there's nothing in the Pali Canon that really goes into it. But she also uses a great deal of real characters, real incidences in the books, and then uses some artistic license. But it's a really good expose of what took place at Kosambi with the monks there. So, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Kosambi intrigue. K-O-S-A-M-B-I intrigue. Susan Stone. So initially, Buddha Dharma was what we took refuge in, or rather the monks took and nuns took refuge in, not Sangha. Sangha hadn't happened yet. And when it did happen, it was established as a place of safety, as a place where people could practice, where more learned monks would teach less new people to the Sangha. And it provided the circumstances to practice in community. How is it to be in community? And the guiding practice for it is called the Vinaya, which is the code of conduct for monastics. I've mentioned this before, so the precepts in it, 226 precepts for monks and 313 for nuns, or is it 311? Well, it's one of those. The Buddha started out with only very basic precepts, five basic precepts, actually only four, and started adding on as things started taking place. I think he, boy, I'm really, I have no idea what he thought, but I would guess, I would guess that he thought teaching the Dhamma and having people so taken with this liberating way of being, they would act appropriately and would be kind to each other and would, listen to the teachings and take advantage of leading the homeless life and all of that. Well, guess what? It didn't happen. And he had to keep adding new precepts and guidelines to the Vinaya and to the conduct of the monks and nuns because things kept taking place. So the Sangha is flawed. You know, that's what he found out, and that's also what we find out, too, in our own Sangha. And by the way, at the time it was called the Eightfold Sangha, which meant there was four steps to enlightenment for men and women. So the four steps are stream enter, once returner, non-returner, and arhant, men and women. So it's the Eightfold Sangha. Later it became the Fourfold Sangha because it was monastic men and women and lay men and women. So the Sangha, he found out, the monastics found out, was disappointing. People weren't practicing as they should. And it happens every place. In our own Sangha, it's happened. I've had people come up saying, I didn't like that talk that you gave or someone else gave. I don't think it's relevant. Or you notice there's cliques. People all hang together. They don't talk to me. You know, it's on and on. People are the Sangha. It's not like some nebulous thing out there. We're it. You know, so we can complain all we want, but we're it. It's not a thing. It's us. So the monastic community had all the same issues. Plus, they had the additional problem as these new rules of conduct were brought up. Guess what? Some monks didn't want to do them. There was a rule right now, which still is followed today, you know, monks and nuns only eat once a day. They do have what's called gruel in the morning, and then they have their main meal of the day. And it used to be that they had a second meal in the evening. But the lay community came to the Buddha and said, you know, we work our butts off all day and we give these guys their food in the morning and then we come home tired from the fields or doing our jobs or being carpenters and there they are at the door again asking for more food. Like I got a family to feed. I don't want to deal with this. And so the Buddha set up a new rule, no eating after noon. We're not going to bother these people who support us. And there was a monk, and there's a sutta about it, who absolutely didn't want to hear that. He said, eating in the evening is good, and I'm going to continue doing it. Well, there was a fight. And the Buddha had to work that one out. In another instance, there was never a rule about no alcohol until, and you remember in the Kosambi intrigue, it's quite a visual that's painted of a monk who gets incredibly drunk. And the lay people are disgusted. We're supporting these people? And look at this guy laying here drunk and had to drag him back. And he was eventually thrown out of the Sangha. And so the Buddha said, okay, no alcohol, not for anybody. So as things happened, you know, new rules were put into effect. So the story of the Kosambi monks is dysfunction at its best. These monks were really incredible. It's almost impossible to believe that they have this enlightened teacher who they have access to for any question that they might have. And not only don't they pay attention, they ignore him completely. So very briefly, I'll give you a rundown on what this whole fracturing of the Sangha was about. And it's so ridiculous, which is usually what takes place in ridiculous fracturing anyway. There apparently was a rule at the time where if a monk took his took the water dipper to get water, he had to drink all the water, empty it out, and put the water dipper back where it's supposed to go. One monk didn't do this. He apparently drank some water, didn't finish it, and left it half filled and put it back. Yes. I mean, this is awful. Another monk reports he did not follow the Vinaya code. He didn't follow the rules of conduct. He should be out of here. Let's get rid of him. And the first monk said, first of all, I didn't do it. And secondly, if I did it, I didn't do it intentionally. And they said, it doesn't matter. You're gone. We want you out. And they called in the Buddha, who did not look at this as right or wrong. He asked them to look at their mental investigation on what they were doing. He wasn't going to solve this. He wanted them to look at, how are you working with the Dhamma? What are you doing in this instance? They ignored him the first time, and they just went back to their arguing with each other, and now it's turning into factionalism. There's two factions, and one faction has now decided that the Vinaya, the code of conduct for monastics, is what we should be following all the time. That's the way to liberation. The other faction said the Dhamma is what we should be following all the time. And that's their faction. So now they've opened it up, not just from this dispute over a water dipper. Now it's completely divided in half, saying, this is the way we've got to be. No, this is the way we've got to be. Gossip. You know, just hard feelings. It was really bad. In fact, when I was reading this in the sutta itself, it doesn't go into all of this, but in the Vinaya, it goes into, there was real concern that the entire monastic community would fall apart, not just this particular monastic community. It was considered so bad what was taking place. So the Buddha's concern was not right or wrong, but what are your ethical values? He also was noticing difficulties are not a sign of failure. This is human nature. Can you recognize it and investigate it? Number two in the seven factors of awakening that Richie's going to be talking about is investigation. Investigating your own mind as to what are you doing? Forget the right or wrong, and I've got more evidence on my side. What are you doing with your own mind? In another case of a quarrelsome sangha, the Buddha taught metta, and that worked. This is Anuruddha's sangha, and these guys got along great. Everything worked out. Said it was like milk and honey or water or something. Anyway, they combined with each other and their likes and dislikes. They worked everything out fine. They used metta, and that was the basis. So the Buddha asked the monks at Kosambi, are you using loving kindness with each other? And they said, no. But they know how to use loving kindness. They know it's important, but no, we're not using it. So he said, all right, I'm going to give you a teaching. And it's almost like a precursor for loving kindness. Like, you know, as you generate loving kindness in your heart, you know, hopefully you have something that will generate that impulse. Most of us do. In fact, Analia talked a bit about this. The five categories that we traditionally use, not in the original teachings. It's a radiating loving kindness. Starting with yourself, all of that's not there. So he had us do it the way the original teachings are, which is you find something that causes, for me, causes your eyes to water, causes your heart to quiver, whatever it is. Analia told, I'm going to get totally off base here, but I'll get back, I promise. Analia said that he was really having trouble with this. He said, my issues are anger. He said, that's what I had to deal with. I get angry very easily, and loving kindness did not come easily to me. And he said, those categories didn't help. You know, it just felt rote, and he was told, like many of us are told, just keep doing it, just keep doing it, eventually it'll come around. And he said it didn't for him. And he was in Sri Lanka taking a walk one day, and he happened to see a Sri Lankan squirrel. I have no idea what a Sri Lankan squirrel looks like, but apparently they're very cute. And he said it had especially cute little twisty ears with little tufts of fur on it. And it just sat there looking at him, and he looked at it, and he felt his heart opening. Just looking at this little animal. And he said, oh, that's metta. That's what metta is. I want this creature to be safe and happy. I really do. After that, he could use metta as part of his practice. So in this case, with the Kosambis, the Kosambi monks, they didn't have that in their hearts. They couldn't even begin to develop it. So the Buddha created another teaching. Oh, here we go with another list, but it's called the Six Principles of Cordiality, or the Six Principles of Delight. So I'm going to read those to you. And my own guess is that he had to do this as a way of starting to develop loving kindness, at least cordiality with these people. If they couldn't be kind, could they at least be cordial and start from that vantage point? So the first three, and these are going to sound very familiar, is maintaining bodily, maintaining verbal, and maintaining mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, toward fellow monastics. You know, as I read this, especially the first two, maintaining bodily and verbal acts, both publicly and privately, I thought of immediately how bullies are. Bullies will often act very appropriate in public with people around, in private, distressing, you know, what they will do to other people, who they wish to hurt, they wish to be cruel to, which is what the monks were doing with each other. And then the third, maintaining mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards fellow monastics. And this is just, remember, our thoughts are our precursor to everything. If we can start with a mental attitude, what else? It's going to come out verbally. It's going to come out in our bodily actions. It's going to come out in our virtues. The fourth one is sharing things with other monastics without reservation. So anything, if they go out alms rounds or some donations were given, everybody gets it equally. Possessing virtues, both in public and private, that are unbroken, unblotched, and lead to concentration. So again, this is going back to the teachings where ethical conduct is the first practice. Meditation is the second. Insight is the third. So he's reminding them, virtue comes before concentration, and you guys have got to start developing that. And then finally, possessing that, and this is the most important one, possessing that view both in public and private that is noble and emancipating and leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. In other words, he's talking about right view. Right view, in this instance, was more important than loving kindness. Everyone had a view. Everyone was sticking to their view. And this was causing all the problems in this Sangha. Each one thinks his view is right. And how many of us have done that? I'm sticking to that view. You know, that's what I believe. This is what's happened. And that's my experience. And I'm going for it. And yet wrong view is clinging to any kind of view. And these monks were not willing to do that. It's also interesting here, and I am just beginning to understand the profundity of this. The Buddha's teachings are not black and white. They change according to the situations, the individuals, the sangha he's dealing with, everything. Everything is fluid. All manners of different ways of thinking are taken into account. The circumstances are taken into account. So in this case, this was the direction he was giving to this particular group of monks. I'm sorry. He also, this is the time when he also mentioned, do you really believe that hatred is not overcome by hatred, but only by love? This is the famous statement in the Dhammapada, and it came from this incident with the Kosambi. So what about right view? He went further on right view. And it, according to one commentary I read, it said, this means that while the Buddha emphasized the importance of loving kindness, he sees that right view leading to liberation as the most important principle for living in harmony with others in this instance. In this particular instance. And in our study guide that Gil gave us on this particular sutta, he said, does this apply in every instance? And that's always something to look at. All the teachings don't always apply in every single instance. It depends on what's involved, who's involved. If you look at the teachings, I mean, he gave so many different teachings to different individuals, depending on who they were, what class they came from, their gender, their amount of practice, everything. That's why we have to go back and investigate for ourselves, where are we with this? So, on right view, and this was an interesting question that somebody asked at the Analio retreat. They said, okay, regarding right view, if you're in delusion, how do you know you're in delusion? Interesting, huh? If you're in delusion, how do you know you're in delusion? What do you think he answered? Actually, he didn't answer. Philip Moffat answered for some reason. They wouldn't let Analio answer a lot of questions. Either Philip or Shyla answered them. But what do you think he answered? How do you know? If you're in delusion, how do you know you're in delusion?
Because
Yeah.
I don't know, but maybe go to a wise teacher mm-hmm. and ask if they think that you're in delusion.
Well, that's what this person was doing, you know, actually putting that out. So, yeah, you're right. That is one way. But that person also wanted an answer.
Well, sitting, I mean, if you're sitting and you might have an opening.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think that's a good answer, too. That isn't the answer that they gave.
What about just noticing your suffering?
That's closer to what they said. They actually said, notice the agitation in the body, because if you're in delusion, you're not at ease. There's agitation, and it's going to affect the mind as well. So there's suffering. And if somebody has to ask, am I in delusion or not, you're most likely are. So that goes back to right view and understanding right view and what does it encompass. And so the Buddha then gave the seven knowledges, which he said lead to stream entry in regards to right view. And the first one is knowing the mind is free of obsession and thus well disposed for seeing things as they really are and awakening to truth. That's a tall order. I mean, yeah, okay, get rid of all your obsessions and see
that's
the truth.
That's the beginning one.
That's the first one. Yes, this is for stream entry. This is, you know, this is good if we get to this point. So essentially he's saying, don't hold on to fixed views. Just don't. Always investigate, is this true or not? And the second one is knowing that with this view, one's mind attains serenity. And this goes back to that question, how do I know when I'm in delusion? Knowing that with this view, one's mind attains serenity.
What view? Sorry.
That is not holding on to a fixed view. And you know, the example I thought of as I read this, have you ever been with maybe two people or a group of people and an argument breaks out or there's discussion and it gets kind of dicey and but you're not taking part of it. You're sitting back. You are not adding to the discord that's taking place. There's an ease that comes up when you are in that situation and know you're not part of the problem. And maybe could even be a calming influence. I think that's what that's saying. And I think we've all been there when we felt that sense of ease. I'm not taking part in it. This is ridiculous. I'm going to stay out of it. The third one is knowing that one's view is consistent with the Buddha's dispensation, not that of other teachers. I think that this is in here because at the time, you know, the Buddha was not well received by the Vedic practitioners in India at the time, and the ceremonies that they took place, which they said had to take place in order for people to achieve liberation, that's how they were supported. I think that's what he was probably referring to, not going back to superstitions, but actually investigating your own mind. I like this one. Knowing oneself to have that character that would lead a person to immediately confess any violation of, in this case, monastic rules and practices, and will practice restraint in the future. So, do you have a character that would encourage people to be honest with you, to feel safe with you, to admit, I've screwed up on something and I need some advice? That's a really special person where you would feel that kind of comfort. There's not too many around. Knowing oneself to have that character that would remain dedicated to training in virtue, meditation, and wisdom, even if he or she is active in monastic affairs. For me, this means like going on with your life. Even though, you know, life is happening, you maintain that virtue, your meditation practice, in the midst of all of it. And then the last two, knowing oneself to have the strength to give careful attention when listening to the Buddha, teaching the Dharma, and knowing oneself to have the strength of someone who is inspired and gladdened in hearing the Buddha teaching the Dharma and the discipline. So the Buddha gave these teachings to the monks at Cozumel, and what did they do? Anyone? You can't say. You read the book.
Ignored him.
That's right. They ignored him. They continued with their infighting. And what did the Buddha do? Yeah. He left.
Out of here.
I'm out of here. I'm done. And he literally walked miles and miles and miles and miles away into seclusion and wanted nothing to do with any of them. And this is when commentaries say this is very close to the ending of, you know, the Dhamma as a spiritual tradition, because he was disgusted. I'll practice by myself. And there's some verses in another book I'm reading called, I can't remember what it's called, it's written by a monk, but it's verses just describing what the Buddha said in various situations. And paraphrasing, he said, I'm so much happier being alone. If I can't have a sangha and friends that are honest and true, I want to be by myself. I'm going to stay out here in the woods and, you know, the hell with them. Well, he didn't say that, but you know what I mean.
He probably said worse.
He probably said worse, you're right. So other monks started, who were not part of the Kosambiya group, would come to him and say, please come back. Please talk to us. We miss you. And he said, no. No, I'm not. And even the Kosambi monks were starting to get a little concerned, not because the Buddha was not speaking to them and not because he had left, but because the lay people said, you guys are awful. We're not supporting you anymore. Don't even bother coming by with your alms bowls. We're not giving you anything. That's what woke them up. That's what woke them up. They went to the Buddha and they said, we are repairing our factions that have caused such problems in the Sangha. And how did they do that? Well, they decided that the guy with the water dipper who didn't empty it all the way would be thrown out of the Sangha, but then he'd be brought back in again as soon as he was thrown out. And that's how they solved it. So the that is the ending of the Kosambi intrigue. And that is the ending of my Dharma talk. Does anybody have any comments or questions?
Are you telling us a word to the wise is sufficient?
I think so. I'm just amazed that they did not pay attention to these wise teachings and just went on with their infighting. It's just phenomenal to me. Okay, well then, it's 8:46. You get to leave a little bit early. Let's just do a final metta. And may all of us be safe and protected from all types of harm and danger. May we be peaceful and happy and healthy and strong. May any disputes that come up between us, Sangha members, family members, co-workers, friends, may we investigate our own motivations and look for wise and calm ways of solving any disputes and not hold on to views that cause harm both to ourselves and others. And may all of us in this room and may all sentient beings everywhere be liberated, completely free in this lifetime.